Welcome to Pediatric Insight, where we have candid conversations with members of the Child Health Advisory Council and some of the nation's top academic child health leaders. I am Wesley Milliken, CEO of Career Physician, and your host. Each conversation addresses a leadership challenge or opportunity that's top of mind for today's pediatric leaders. The council breaks it down based on the wisdom and experience obtained throughout their distinguished careers. And now, I'm honored to turn it over to the moderator in today's conversation.
Thank you for joining us for the latest Pediatric Insight conversation. My name is Bruce Rubin. I'm joined by the Child Health Advisory Council and a guest, Dr. Amélie von Saint-André von Arnim. She's an attending physician at Seattle Children's, associate professor of pediatrics at the University of Washington, and she also directs the University of Washington Critical Care and Emergency Training Program in Nairobi, Kenya. Today's topic is advising candidates who have an interest in global health. And the background is candidates for a faculty position will sometimes ask about opportunities to participate in global health projects. Some have established global health involvement, perhaps grant-funded, perhaps long-standing involvement, and others just have an interest in contributing and being involved in global health, perhaps with limited background or having done maybe a mission trip at some time. And so I want to begin by asking, what types of global health programs are candidates looking for? What have your department offered, and what are the benefits and risks for a department? And I'll begin with Valerie Opapari.
Well, thanks, Bruce. I have experience when I was chair that we developed a number of collaborative global health efforts. But I have to say that, you know, when I reflect back on them, they're very difficult in this sense that they really require a longitudinal investment of time and energy and resources. And even if you have, you mentioned grant funding or foundation funding, it's never enough to fully cover the costs of the work. So we launched several global health efforts in China and a very large one in Ethiopia. And they were done in collaboration with other departments, most specifically the Department of OB-GYN, and also with our dean's office, where we had a vice dean who had as part of his portfolio developing global efforts and outreach. Definitely the students, the residents, the fellows, the faculty all have expressed an interest. But I think that fulfilling that interest for the number of individuals who come to you with that interest is really tough. So I think you have to really work hard to match the interests of the individuals if they haven't gotten any previous experience and help them to learn that this is a longitudinal effort on their part. It's just not something they can drop in and do. But the value is great to help your candidates and your faculty and trainees learn about the diversity and the resource limitations of different places that you go to is learning that can't be reproduced in any other setting. And I think that you have the opportunity to export some of your care models, not obviously all of them that we do, but a good number of them can be modified to provide care locally. We did a lot of virtual work out in rural areas in Ethiopia and found ways to use technology to help advance that kind of effort. But I think it's a win-win for everybody, but it's not something you can just like today say, oh, I think we'll have a global health program and, you know, start it anew.
Well, Dr. Arnie Strauss, you've led two large departments. What are your insights?
So I agree with Valerie as always. It's crucial to think long-term and it's crucial to understand that it's going to cost money. But the return on investment is huge because of the interest of residents and fellows, because their careers can be developed in global health, and because of the educational opportunity. So my focus or my approach was to augment the interests of faculty that already had, for example, interest in sickle cell disease in Africa with our chief of hematology, interest in education and residency training, developing residency training in Malawi, and in China, exchange programs. And I would make the point that exchange of faculty and students is really, really important. And it benefits both institutions by bringing knowledge about diseases that we don't see in the United States much anymore, but also in then exporting opportunities to care for patients in another country. And I'll just give one example of the benefits in China of genetic testing, which were non-existent when we started there 15 years ago and now are essentially universal. And what that has done is to increase the database about rare diseases, about genetic variability, about phenotypic variability. So there's been, as Valerie said, mutual benefit that is huge. And I must say, I think has also made it easier to understand beyond the differences of our political leadership, why it's so important to have these relationships around the world.
Thank you, Arnie. Yes, it really does go both ways. We found, particularly since the pandemic, when people are becoming much more comfortable with remote learning, that we've been able to provide consultation and discussion both directions and to get by the time zone, sometimes even asynchronously by pre-recording lectures. It certainly has opened up opportunities. Emily, you're directly involved in this right now. What would you add?
Thank you. I think the important, very important points have been raised. I agree that, you know, I think you need to differentiate between the people who want to just do a little bit of global health as a side, and then also those who want to make it their careers, because I think there's a difference between the two. So I think for folks who don't have much experience in global health projects, but want to kind of get started and see what it's like, I think having a local community at your academic center that is active in global health and having existing collaborations and programs where people are able to more easily fit in and have some experiences and sort of travel there or make connections in a mentored fashion and then can expand if they wish from, you know, in terms of what their areas of interests are, is very helpful, I think. So for our program in pediatric emergency and critical care, we offer both online teaching and also people can go in person. And it's been really fantastic to see the enthusiasm from so many people across many, many different institutions. We have volunteers from over 100 institutions who give lectures virtually. And that is a nice way to get started and see and interact with our fellows. And then the next step, if they continue to be interested, is to go. But this actually also requires a team of people who will prepare these colleagues to go. And it requires an institution that is open for that, both in terms of flexible schedules, especially for clinicians, but also in terms of, you know, what's the malpractice insurance? Is that covered? I mean, there's all these little things that I think are just minor, but to make this actually happen, a system and an infrastructure needs to be in place. And that's a lot easier when you have programs that enable that and it's set up and then people can just go. You were asking also about risks for an academic center. So cost is obviously one of them. But I think if you do have longstanding relationships, those risks actually become less and less, and you will more and more see the win-win for both sides, which was already pointed out. I do think that for faculty that is making global health sort of their primary career, I think there is more of a risk for maybe a delayed promotion, because the infrastructure is different. Getting IRBs approved on both sides and making progress with communication sometimes can be more challenging in those settings. So I think that could be potentially a risk for the institution here. I absolutely agree with getting, you know, making bilateral exchanges. We have started doing that for our programs in Seattle and Kenya, and it's been really enriching. I would also say that we've sent a bunch of colleagues over there, and what I have observed, and I haven't studied that, but people come back really invigorated. And I think especially sort of post-pandemic, there's a big burnout and people come back and are just, you know, getting back to just taking care of patients and doing the right thing and having had a good experience, and then sort of being also more appreciative of their work and our side of the world has a big impact. So that, you know, you can't put that in numbers, but our division chair recently went and he came back so happy. And it was great to see that.
Thank you. Dr. Brutus Stapleton, you have some contributions to make.
I would like to point out that when candidates come, it was important to understand what kind of global health experience they were interested in. And was it service? Did they want to go and provide a public health type service? Did they want to go and were they interested in a more clinical experience? Or was it an academic research focused? And each of those requires different resources and different infrastructures. So trying to understand each of those has different impacts on that individual's career. One of the things that I don't think has been mentioned is that global health doesn't have to be an international experience. There are global health issues. We were a Somali relocation site, and some of our residents began doing service to that community, teaching Somalian girls to swim and do things. So global health doesn't necessarily have to be travel to an international country, but there are opportunities locally sometimes to be engaged in global health, especially if your community has those resources.
I'd like to follow on with something that you just brought up, Bruder, and something that Emily mentioned. And I'd like to hear how people think about global health as an academic focus. How do these activities influence promotion and tenure? What are the department or school's expectations for participation, and how are these outcomes measured? And I'll start with Danielle LaRocque, because you've served in every leadership capacity.
Thank you. And I'm following the conversation just to tap on something that Bruder just mentioned, which stole my thunder a little bit, but I always refer to local global. And the reason is that somehow when we speak about global, we omit the United States as part of the global community. So it always makes me chuckle to say that when we apply that, especially when we're looking at global in terms of contributing to areas because of a need, of a service need, an educational need, a research need. So I think those conditions occur in our own country as well as abroad. So thank you, Bruder, for bringing that point. So I think a lot of the points have been made, which is what's the motivation for involvement in global health? Is it to contribute to a specific specialty and to do that in a setting outside of one's own country, so host country? Or is it an academic pursuit? And there are certain structures with respect to an academic pursuit, okay? But before I go to that, if you would allow me, I think there are certain competencies, whether it is for clinical care, for education or research, which are really important. If you saw me just reach out for the book, it's one of the things that we developed when I was APA president-elect, which was global competencies, which have to do with values and ethics, roles and responsibilities, communication, teamwork, and team-based interactions. The reason that's important is because a principle around global health is do no harm. Do not go to a country and not collaborate with the ministries of health and the health systems that are already in existence and come with the perspective that you are saving the world. I'm being a little dramatic because my colleagues on this talk obviously get those principles. It's do no harm. And I'll give you an example from my own dear country, Haiti. After the devastating earthquake in 2010, is that, as you recall, 250,000 to 300,000 individuals lost their lives within minutes. And there was a real response from folks that were both engaged in global health activities before, as well as folks who wanted to help. A number of principles came around with respect to that, is that, and we have a surgeon on our team here, Bob Zorin, who knows this, is that surgery requires pre-op, operative, and post-operative care. And then sometimes when we intervene quickly, we don't think of the continuity of care. And that goes for research and for education. So I'll answer the question, can global activities be an academic focus? Absolutely. Okay. And it can be in the same metrics as folks who are interested in promotion. So you could be interested in promotion from a clinical track, You can be interested in a clinical education track. You can be interested in a clinical research track or a basic science track, right? That's not new. The same metrics apply. The same metrics apply in terms of promotion. If it's in the clinical mastery track, which many universities have, you have to show scholarly work, scholarly products as a result of your clinical interaction. I think we mentioned that, for example, if you're a residency program director, well, you know, have you looked at an educational model that can be translated bidirectionally in terms of building programs? If it's around clinical research and your area is sickle cell disease, then obviously the world, you know, I mean, the origins of sickle cell disease are geographic, and how can you partner with others in clinical research? And if it's basic science, the same applies. So I think the answer is absolutely it can be an academic focus. One of the areas that you might look at if you're looking for an academic career in global health, is there an institute at that university that has cross-departmental collaboration, right? I think Valerie mentioned that when they did a number of things, they were collaborating across departments. You could develop those collaborations individually, but there might be some institutions that have an institutional cross-departmental, cross-school even, you know, faculties like collaboration. And so, and R01 funding is certainly available for that. And I would be remiss in not mentioning the Fogarty in terms of NIH that has some set principle about bidirectional capacity building. Right. So what we want to do when we participate as global citizens is to be good partners. Capacity building in research and education and clinical care means that we learn from each other. OK. And the Fogarty has established that at Columbia. I'm now involved in the GRIT around mental health, trauma, and education. And that is funded by a Fogarty grant, which is familiar to many of you. Anyway, the answer is yes. And yes, you should be able to get promoted through that track. And what are the department's expectations? Well, the same as scholarly work in any area. Okay, is it continuous? Is it, you know, creates a career path? Although I would say don't feel like you need to stay in that lane. There are many opportunities to continue to develop an academic career. And there may be some, you know, branch off points where you say, well, I'm very interested in this infectious disease, or there's a pandemic that's there. How can I apply those skills in my academic career? So I'll stop there, but I think it's a great topic. And recruiting candidates to be involved in global health with some operating principles and competencies is really a wonderful field.
I think Danielle and Amelie have both touched on a lot of the important points. And I want to reiterate what was said about how the academic opportunities exist. Yet I think Amelie pointed out that perhaps there are a few more barriers, and so things can progress a little more slowly, perhaps. But I think the landscape's changing. A lot of the surgical specialty societies, for example, have entire sections of their annual meetings devoted to global health, where papers are presented, and journals, I believe, are starting to have sections that are devoted to global health. So there's, I think, an expanding universe of opportunities for scholarship in global health, which is important. I know many of the surgical societies are also sponsoring fellowship programs and faculty opportunities for surgeons to become engaged in global surgery. So I should also mention that paper that was, I guess, now 10 years ago in Lancet identified that surgical trauma is perhaps the number one public health issue in the world. And so the need for surgical involvement in global health is unquestionable. And thankfully, there are a lot of colleagues in the various surgical specialties who have embraced that. I think Danielle mentioned that there are funding opportunities. I don't know whether the odds are any better. I suspect they're a little more challenging to compete in that space because the dollars aren't as large. But there are also a lot of foundations and philanthropies that are willing to fund research and academic activity in a global space. So as was mentioned, It takes a strong commitment on the part of the faculty member that you have to be in it for the long run. You have to have support from your department and your school. And thankfully, I think that most major academic medical centers have made significant progress in that regard.
What additional advice would you give to that candidate who expresses an interest? What background or what preparation would you advise? And I'd like to start with Dr. Craig Hillmeyer.
I think that one of the things that's really important for a candidate who's considering a program is to really understand the commitment of that program to international health. And I think one of the best ways to do that is look at their track record and ask about that track record and to have the opportunity to talk with faculty who've been involved in the global health program and find out so that they have realistic expectations of what that experience is going to be like if they decide to go to that program, because it's really not, as I think Valerie mentioned earlier, aspirations are oftentimes fleeting and people can be interested in something, but it takes a lot of work to set up these programs. And you need, as a prospective faculty member, to understand how similar faculty who've had those feelings have been treated and how they are taken care of by the program, because it doesn't necessarily just fit into the call every third night or every fourth night paradigm. I mean, there are accommodations that need to be made for that and support that needs to be given. So.
Emily, as a physician who is really focused on this, what advice would you give to a candidate, both the candidate who has a limited background and the candidate that may already be involved in global health?
I think the devil is always in the details, right? So even for people who are very enthusiastic, so the institutional barriers can sometimes be a challenge. So I think agree with the previous speaker, really meeting with as many people as possible who are involved in global health at that institution to sort of see what the support services are, how open are the IRBs to international studies? Are there any internal funding mechanisms as startup funds? Is there any travel support? How flexible is the schedule, the clinical schedule, to allow for travel away? Who could be mentors? And I think the importance is to have a broad network. And so this, you might not find the perfect person and all the support in the applicant's division, but potentially in the department or university wide. And I think knowing that these support structures are there, having an administration that as open to starting new collaborations, to be helpful with setting up MOUs and overall sort of having an interest in the growth of global health. I think those would be very important points that I see.
I just wanted to add another perspective for us to think about too, which is, you know, the world is a very volatile place. And some of us have had experience with well-established global health efforts that came to a crashing halt with unease in the political arena. And I think it's a really important part of thinking about this in many senses. Obviously, you want to make sure your faculty and trainees are clued in with the travel office, the HR office, the global health offices to make sure that the, you know, trips are well prepared for, as was already said. But I think the other thing you have to think about is what would happen if this program got decimated? How are you going to continue to support that faculty member who's launched their career with this as a specific area? Because sadly, that has happened to young individuals. And, you know, I think that that's part of the preparation that you as a leader, when you're working with faculty in these areas, have to always be thinking about, you know, what are some of the side areas of research interest and academic work that they do that, God forbid, if this whole program came to a halting stop, they would be able to continue and be successful. And it's also part of some of the comments Danielle made about putting individuals through promotion, understanding that some of this work takes much longer to do and is fraught with some logistical issues potentially in terms of getting completed. And Bruce, I think there's probably nobody better than you to talk about some of this since you've done such incredible work in a very volatile place. So maybe you have some perspectives to share with us on this, but clearly there's so much positive, but it's also a challenge at times, or could be. And I think we have to just keep that balanced perspective when we think about this. as an opportunity.
Thank you, Valerie. I will mention it, but I'd like to call Dr. Stapleton first. Bruder.
Well, I'd like just to extend a little bit of what Valerie said, and that not only is the risk to a collapse of a program, but the safety of individuals who are participating in another country doing an exchange. We had one individual years ago that we had to help arrange through the university an exit in a very volatile area. So there is risk to the individual. And I think Amelie made a wonderful point that you really have to, for someone who is going to have an academic focus, and that's going to be their career success metric, it is challenging doing global work. I've had a couple of people who hit years getting IRBs. One of them sort of had to give up and move into a different area because they just couldn't get it done, even in the presence of a well-established infrastructure at that institution and at the University of Washington. So an academic career in global health needs to be very heavily supported and have an infrastructure available to support that individual. An individual who has a great idea launching off as an initial effort as an assistant professor is going to have a challenging time if it's an ambitious project. So that's just a point I wanted to make.
So to Valerie's alluded to this, I've had three different, very different global health experiences. My lab for many years has been largely run by graduate students and postdocs from Japan for a number of reasons. And we've also been able to send some of our trainees to work in established labs from some of my former trainees in Japan. And that's been research intensive. It's been funded externally. It's been certainly a research collaboration more than anything else. In Guatemala, I was invited to join the board of a new children's hospital there a few years ago, where my role is largely educational, not just going there, but I'm currently trying to set up a remote educational program with speakers across pediatrics to speak there. But, you know, with the onset of the pandemic, I gave a number of talks in places around the world where I haven't traveled before, became very close to colleagues in Ukraine, and have been out in Ukraine working, Children's Hospital in Lviv, and we'll be going to Kyiv soon. And as others have said, it's incredibly enriching, incredibly motivating. You know, despite being in a war zone, have never directly felt unsafe. Again, part of that has been helping the people there who've had difficulty getting full training to find folks that they could train with. I have a colleague at the Motol Children's Hospital in Prague who helps to run the bronchoscopy program for Europe, and we sent pulmonologists from Ukraine to take this program free of charge with my friend's help. So the opportunities can be diverse. Some of these are based on individual interests, but all of them, as many people have said so eloquently, particularly Amelie, are incredibly enriching. I thank you all for listening to today's conversation. If you'd like to listen to other Pediatric Insight conversations, please visit our website, careerphysician.com, and click on Pediatric Insights. Thank you all very much.